I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, a very special conversation with a guest who, I have to be honest, helped inspire this show, Scott Horton. If you're not familiar with Scott, he's the host of The Scott Horton Show, which I used to listen to in my teenage years. I think he's a great journalist. He's written two very invaluable books related to the War on Terror, the first being Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terror. I'm not kidding. When I was a teenager, I used to listen to Scott Horton's show with my dad. I'd keep up with all his coverage of the wars during the Bush and Obama years, and he was a very pivotal influence on me. So hopefully I don't sound too intimidated during this conversation. Scott's a bit of a hero to me. Really, I hope I don't sound like too much of a fanboy in the course of this conversation. But Scott has been really invaluable as a resource and as just an inspiration for how I like to do things at Parallax Views. I think his radio program, which has been going since the dawn of the War on Terror in different forms, I mean, amazing. He's had an amazing career as a radio host and as an astute critic of the war party in the United States of America. And in this conversation, which was recorded at the beginning of the month, September 3rd to be exact, Scott and I reflected on 20 years of the War on Terror, the architects behind it, the withdrawal from Afghanistan, and much, much more. So with that in mind, let's get right to the conversation with Scott Horton. Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest I've been meaning to speak to for some time now. Host of the Scott Horton Show, Scott Horton himself, author of Fool's Errand and Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terror, and also, I would say, the radio host who I sort of model my own show after in a lot of ways. How's it going, Scott Horton?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. How are you doing?
Pretty good. You have been doing a lot of interviews lately. You were recently on Kennedy Nation. You've been talking a lot about Afghanistan. What's your general take after 20 years? We were, told that we went to Afghanistan to stop the Taliban, and the Taliban's back in power.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing was for nothing. And I'm sorry to say that, I don't know, it's true that I'm one of the many who said all along that this is crazy to try to have a war to tame the Pashtun population of Afghanistan. It's just never going to work. And there are plenty of people who said all along that it's not going to work. And, you know, I guess I'm not sure what year it was. It was probably Eric Margolies would have been the first to explain to me in what, 04, 05, maybe, probably 04, that it could be even as far back as 03, certainly probably by 04, that essentially we're trying to foist a coalition of ethnic minorities onto, you know, as a government, onto the plurality of the country. And so, you know, the Tajiks, the Uzbeks, and the Hazaras, who are right around 20% each, up against the 40% Pashtuns, who are, you know, the supermajority in the areas where they're predominant, they are, you know, absolutely predominant in the south and east of the country and a few places in the north. But yeah, it's just clear all along. These people have no reason to give in to us, and we have no reason to think that they're going to. No reason in the world to think we create a central federal government there. And, you know, for all the talk about women's rights and democracy and a modern nation state and all this, they dumbed down all those goals, girls' schools and everything. All that got dumbed down to, well, we're going to see if we can create a government and an army that can hold it together at all. And then they couldn't even do that. You know, they couldn't accomplish even that, creating a government that could last without them even for a day. I mean, South Vietnam lasted for 2 years after the withdrawal. Kabul lasted for the withdrawal wasn't even over yet. It fell almost immediately, as I predicted for years on various interviews and in different ways, that when it came down to it, they just walked right into Kabul. It wasn't even a siege or a battle. They just walked right in and took it over.
I was just going to ask that. I was just talking to a mutual friend of ours, Jim Bovard. He was on my show recently. We were talking about how even under Karzai, there were laws put in place that weren't exactly very nice to women's rights. So, you know, I feel like the women's rights thing almost becomes an excuse. Is that really why we were there? And I think the real reasons I think the real reasons we were there are discussed in both of your books, Fool's Errand and Enough Already. And what I wanted to start with is why we ended up in Afghanistan and why this war on terror happened. And in a way, as you argue in both books, this was a gift to Osama bin Laden. Could you explain that a little for my listeners?
Sure. Yeah. And in his 2004 speech, he makes it really clear that his plan is to bog us down and bleed us to bankruptcy. And as he kind of puts it, roughly paraphrasing, isn't it ironic that your government sees fit to accomplish all my goals for me because it benefits politically connected corporations at the expense of the rest of you? Couldn't have put it better. And it's just as simple as that. And in fact, he says, you know, you know, your government and my team are allies in this effort, even if for different reasons. That's the way he puts it. You know, Al-Qaeda and the U.S. government teamed up against the American people to wage this horrible war, to run our, you know, empire and society into the ground. But some people get to cash in off it, namely Al-Qaeda and Lockheed and Likud. You know, whatever, you know, narrow special interests at the expense of everybody else. It's kind of simple as that. Now, to go back, in fact, I just wrote an article about this. My last article is for antiwar.com. It's called Peter Bergen is Mistaken About Bin Laden's Strategy. And Peter Bergen says, look, Bin Laden always said America's a paper tiger. We're going to lure you in, but then we're going to whoop your ass and then force you right out and you're going to run away. And then he says, but that didn't work. America double, triple, quadruple down. Call us a paper tiger, will you? We'll go big then. Well, and so then after the fact, he tried to rationalize it. Oh, yeah. No, I was trying to drag you in and bog you down and bleed you to bankruptcy and all that, because now that fits the narrative after the fact. He said that in his big 2004 speech, as I just said. But go back and check the record. He said that to Abd al-Bari Atwan in 1996, that he wanted to drag us into a war of attrition. Ayman al-Zawahiri talked about moving the battle to the heart of the Middle Eastern world for an epic clash, you know, not paper tiger running you off with a couple of truck bombs, but an apocalyptic confrontation with the U.S. where we lose the long and the hard way. And I quote in the book, too, I think it was the deputy secretary of the Navy for intelligence, some kind of thing. I'm sorry, I'm totally botching that title, but something like that. And I quote the guy in Fool's Errand saying that essentially, you know, the same argument. Plan A was try to get America to withdraw. Plan B was to try to drag us in, bog us down, bleed us out, and force us out the long and the hard way so we'd stay out that way.
Vietnam,
and as Bin Laden's son put it, Bin Laden's son said, all my father wanted was to lure the Americans into invading Afghanistan. He would do to them the same thing that he did to the Russians. And so then, you know, if that's all he ever wanted was Afghanistan, and he already won, then what does it mean that Bush went and knocked over Saddam Hussein and invaded Somalia. And then Barack Obama, you know, waged the regime change war in Libya and half of one in Syria that led to the rise of the Islamic State, then moved on to fight for AQAP in Yemen. I mean, this is all absolutely beyond Osama bin Laden's wildest dreams for radicalizing and destabilizing the region and discrediting America's sock puppet states. The only things that they haven't gotten yet is bin Laden didn't get to make himself the king of Saudi, and Zawahiri didn't get to make himself the Pharaoh of Egypt, and the Ayatollah still sits on the throne in Tehran, and frankly, Assad still sits on the throne in Damascus. But other than that, they've accomplished, so what do you call that, like 80% of al-Qaeda's agenda in the last 20 years instead of 100% of it? But for all the 9/11 truthers, they might as well be reverse 9/11 truthers and just look at it like this. Who benefits? Al-Qaeda benefits. They got exactly what they wanted.
I just wanted to add to that. I think that's an interesting point because, you know, there almost is this weird symbiotic relationship between the neocons and the sort of radical bin Laden types, because they both benefit from the existence of the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely right. It's a transmission belt of power, as Raimondo would put it. You know?
So, in regards to the war on terror itself, and I know we could take this back really, really far. I think you could even take stuff back to 1953, Operation Ajax, the overthrow of Mossadegh. But in a lot of ways, you start things with 1979. Why 1979?
Well, just because there's so many different things that, you know, all sort of broke off that year. So it's true that I also immediately go back to 53, because you can't talk about Iran 79 without talking about 53. But in 79, you had Saddam Hussein's overthrow of his buddy al-Bakr to become the new dictator of Iraq. You had the revolution in Iran where the Ayatollah Khomeini came to power. And you had the beginning of the operation to back the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. Now, I like to make the point that when the Ayatollah was coming to power, the Shah was dying of cancer, and the Carter government knew it. And there was nothing that they could do to save that regime. And so Ayatollah Khomeini was essentially their second best option. They let the French let him get on the plane and go home to Iran to inherit the revolution. And it was because the State Department and the CIA said, we know this guy from back in 53, helped us overthrow Mossadegh, or help, you know, soften up the Mossadegh regime and agitate against him as part of this group of clerics. So we know this guy. We can get along with him. He's fine. And the truth is, the Carter government got along with the Ayatollah's government, or tried to, all through 1979. The hostage crisis didn't break out until November, when he let the Shah into the country for cancer treatment. And at that point, that's what caused the riot and the seizing of the hostages at the embassy, which is where the last coup had been based out of, and all that. But people always conflate that together and just think, oh, pure evil Iranian revolution, all that. Well, first of all, they were overthrowing a fascist dictator that we had no right to do a coup and install over them in the first place. And then secondly, we're getting along that whole time. Fat Carter was passing the Ayatollah intelligence warning him of threats from the Soviet Union and Saddam Hussein's Iraq. And so then, now take the other section there from 79. In July, Carter signed a finding ordering the CIA to start backing the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. And in order, the explicit purpose of this was to provoke and draw the Soviet Union in. Now, Eric Margolies and Andrei Sakharov both said that that's not why the Soviets invaded. They invaded because their own guy, I always forget his name, was it Amin? Was their guy who was the dictator at the time. And the first thing that happened, the day the Soviet Union invaded, the KGB took the guy out back and shot him in the head and replaced him with a new guy because he was doing such a lousy job. So that was essentially why they invaded. But it doesn't matter. The provocation was still for a reason. And there's still, you know, the lesson to be learned from that provocation still remains, even if that's not really the reason the Soviets invaded. But once they did invade Christmas 79, Zbigniew Brzezinski said, now we can give the Soviets their own Vietnam. It's right there. And in fact, it's at scotthorton.org/fair use. If you want to go and you can find those memos there. Now, then they panicked, though, Because once the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, they said, well, what if they roll into revolutionary Iran, newly weakened revolutionary Iran? They could take over the Persian Gulf. And that's when Carter's government then. So this is the invasion of Afghanistan they were trying to provoke. Once they got it, they said, oh, no. Now, if they do the next thing on our list of possible dominoes to fall, that could lead to a major problem. So they announced the Carter Doctrine. Soviet Union, don't invade Iran. We're essentially giving a war guarantee to this country that we're right in the middle of this hostage crisis with them. But warning the Soviet Union, you better not invade Iran or you're going to have a problem with us, treating it like it's West Germany or something. And then as part of that same Carter Doctrine, they started building up the bases in the Arabian Peninsula, and they gave the green light. Carter gave the green light in early 1980 to Saddam Hussein to invade Iran. And so the reason why Hussein wanted to invade Iran is because he is a minority Sunni Arab dictator sitting on a supermajority Shiite population, 60% Shiite Arabs, in all the land from Iran over to Baghdad, which is a mixed city in the middle, kind of. So once the revolution broke out, there were a bunch of Iraqis who took Iran's side in the revolution. And Saddam was afraid they all were going to essentially choose their religious sect as Shiites over their national and ethnic sect as Iraqis and Arabs. So as a solution to that, he conscripted them all and invaded Iran to try to overthrow the Ayatollah and cancel and kill the Islamic, Shiite Islamic revolution in its crib. And when he couldn't do that, it just led to this massive stalemate war that lasted all through the 1980s, where America mostly supported Saddam. They're more famous for selling weapons to Iran during this time because that broke out into the massive Iran-Contra scandal. But for the most part, they were backing Iraq during that time, including paying for Iraq to buy chemical weapons from the Europeans and using and giving him American satellite intelligence so that he could use that intelligence to better target the Iranians during the war with sarin and Tabin nerve gas and other horrible chemical weapons, the worst chemical warfare since World War I. And then once that war was over, that war led directly then to the dispute over war debts between Iraq and Kuwait, and the Kuwaitis calling in their loans and Saddam unable to pay them back and unable to, to rebuild. And they're adding insult to injury and saying things like, oh, well, if you can't send us your money, maybe you just send us your war widows and this kind of thing. You know, like Americans would react really well to some foreign nation taunting our war widows. Yeah. Anyway, the Iraqis, they didn't react that well to that. And they threatened to invade. And essentially, I think the fairest interpretation of this is that James Baker's State Department gave Saddam Hussein a flashing yellow light. Like when I was 12, I would always try to bum cigarettes from the guy at the skate shop, but he would never give me cigarettes because I was just a little kid. But what he would do is look away and then I would steal one out of his pack. And that was essentially the game that James Baker and Saddam Hussein were playing. But then once Saddam Hussein did invade, he took the whole country. He was supposed to just kind of overthrow the, take over the northern oil fields. Instead, he went too far. And by overthrowing the entire monarchy and everything like that, he then was threatening British interests. And so Margaret Thatcher really was the leading force in encouraging and really insisting that H.W. Bush launch Iraq War I in order to force Iraq out of Kuwait. And as I cover in the book, Bush Sr. essentially denied every opportunity for negotiation throughout the entire second half of the year 1990. Once they said, this will not stand, new world order, we're going to have a war, then you couldn't back them down from that now. And so they did it. Now, I'm going somewhere with this. Here's the problem. Everybody thought Iraq War I was fine, short and sweet and easy. But the problem is, we've been bombing them for 30 years since then. And as I like to say this year, I'm not rounding up. Really, it's been 30 years that we've been bombing Iraq, 2021 here. So what happened in the short, sweet Iraq War I, Desert Storm, Operation Yellow Ribbon? What happened was those Iraqi Shiites who had sided with the Iranians during the Iranian Revolution 10 years earlier, Well, they decided to, well, 12 years earlier, they decided to rise up and try to overthrow Saddam Hussein. And at first, Bush Sr. encouraged it and put out a message over Voice of America asking them to do it and drop leaflets over Iraqi army divisions, encouraging them to march on Baghdad. Pardon me. But then the Iraqis, who had chosen Iran's side in the Iran-Iraq war and had sided with their Shiite sect and the revolution, they started coming back across the border to lead the revolution backed by Iran. So the Bush senior administration realized, what had they done? They just spent 10 years backing Saddam Hussein to contain the Iranian revolution, Shiite revolution. Now they're importing it. And they don't want to do that. So they called it off. They choked. And then they let Saddam Hussein keep his helicopters and tanks and massacre 100,000 people to put down the insurrection. Brutal massacre. And then they said, well, see, we have to stay. Told you he's Hitler. And, you know, after doing this thing. But meanwhile, the insurrection had been crushed. They didn't have to stay to protect the Iraqi Shiites or the Kurds from Saddam at that point. I mean, he could have gone after, you know, people he wanted to go after in terms of kidnapping and assassination and stuff. But as far as he wasn't just going to keep mass killing them all, the insurrection had been crushed. But that became the excuse to stay, not just for Bush Sr., but then for Bill Clinton. And they stayed through the entire 1990s, bombing Iraq from bases in Saudi Arabia. And that was the primary reason that the Arab Afghan army that had gone to Afghanistan to fight in the Mujahideen war against the Soviet Union there then turned around and focused their enmity against the United States. And, you know, essentially the theory was they had no hope of waging their local revolutions until they got the Americans out of the way. Because as the global superpower standing behind the Saudi king and the Egyptian so-called president, they could never get their way. Now, the reality is they could never get their way anyway. We're talking about 400 guys. We're talking about bin Laden and some of his loser bandit friends with no real support anywhere in the world and no ability to overthrow a damn thing. But anyway, this was their strategy. And, you know, John Miller said, the ABC News reporter who interviewed bin Laden, he later told Peter Bergen. Yeah, bin Laden told him, oh, yeah, man, I'm going to war. Me and my buddies here, we're going to war against the USA. How do you like that? We're going to kill you all. How do you know? What do you think about that? And John Miller says that he said to himself, yeah, you and what army, pal? But then the answer was the U.S. Army, you know, based on information from guys like John Miller going, yeah, bin Laden said we're a paper tiger that will turn and run like a little sissy. So we better not do that. We better do a full scale of invasion of Afghanistan just to prove to him we'll never fall for that kind of thing, which is exactly what he was doing. Again, as his son said, you know, America ran into Afghanistan like a bull that runs after the red scarf, fell for it. And that's not to say that Bush is some innocent victim. That's to say that bin Laden was astute to see that Bush was the kind of cynical warmongering corporatist who would leap at the chance to cynically exploit any terrorist crisis in order to go to war and drive the empire into the ground. And you know what? I'm just lucky I figured this out so early, you know? I kind of assumed at the time that bin Laden was a CIA agent or whatever because I was kind of stupid and young. I don't think that. But I did think that sort of at the time. But I did kind of hold out for the possibility that that wasn't true. And I said, well, you know, if this bin Laden guy was really trying to get America to quit the empire, boy, was this a stupid way to go about it. I mean, they just gave the New World Order a giant kick in the ass. Now Bush and Cheney can do whatever they want. They're going to go to Iraq and go to Afghanistan and, you know, maybe Iran and whatever else they want. So this bin Laden guy, he really thought this is how to fight the empire. Boy, is he an idiot. But then, no, that's not right. And I read like a month later, or 6 weeks later or something, William Norman Grigg in the New American Magazine. And he quoted Saul Alinsky, pretty sure it's page 75 of Rules for Radicals, that in all asymmetric political action, including terrorism, the action is in the reaction of the opposition. So in other words, somebody knocks your towers full of civilians down. What's going on? Well, they're trying to make you really mad. Why? Is it just, oh, because you're a paper tiger, they want you to run away? Like, the madder you are, the more you owe it to yourself to take a breath, take a shot, sit down, calm down, and think this through. They're trying to get a reaction out of you. What's the opposite of that? Think it through. Act smart. Be prudent, as George H.W. Bush would say while he was in the middle of not being prudent at all. You know? And so instead, what America do? Oh, we're USA number one superpower. You can't stop us. We're going to war in 60 nations, Bush announced. Right? The reaction of the opposition, as Will Grigg got it right away, man, before Bin Laden even got away at Tora Bora. My buddy over at the John Birch magazine had it right, that Bin Laden is giving our government an opportunity to go overboard, to cynically exploit a crisis, to run our country into the ground. And, you know, probably Will was blessed with that insight because as a Bircher, he had been, you know, completely educated in the whole Bircher conspiracy that all American wars are meant to drag America down. That essentially it's all part of the New World Order or whatever to bankrupt America so that one day we'll get taken over by the UN or whatever it is. Well, whatever. Forget the stupid part of that. How about the part where empire is suicide? How about the part where if there was a treasonous plot to destroy America, this is what it would look like. You'd have to go to war in country after country after country till everything finally fell apart. Because otherwise, how could you take us down other than carpet bombing us with H-bombs? But we'll hit you back. You try that, right? So how else can you do it? How can you destroy America? Well, hire the Republicans and Democrats to run it and then drive a couple of planes into a couple of towers and then let them rip. See what they do. And they'll spend $10 trillion. They'll kill a million people and they'll ruin everything. They'll drive the empire into the ground. And frankly, it wasn't even a brilliant move by Bin Laden, right? It was just, you know, like in they always talk about themselves on TV. You know, these DC people always talk about their calculus. It's just arithmetic, right? It's just basic mathematics. Here's what I'm going to do. In fact, this is, again, Bin Laden's son said, I was in Afghanistan in 2000 when Bush was elected. My father was so happy. Here's the kind of president he needs, one who will attack and spend money and break the country, right? Mr. Tough Guy is not terrifying. He's the perfect mark. George W. Bush, Mr. Fake Cowboy Hat, pretend, you know, cowboy strut, is the perfect idiot to provoke into blowing $10 trillion and blowing the American people's brains out.
I was just going to add to that. I think it's interesting. It's almost like Bin Laden took Brzezinski's idea of, you know, pull the Soviets in to a new Vietnam, and he did it with us. And it's interesting to me, too. I want to note this because I think people sometimes assume that there's a completely straight line from Brzezinski to the neocons. And I think there's major differences between Brzezinski and the neocons. Even H.W. Bush, I mean, according to Ray McGovern, he would refer to people like Cheney and Rumsfeld as the crazies in the basement of Middle East foreign policy. So I guess that leads us to who are the neocons and how do they differ from some of the other characters in this sordid story?
Well, it's not Cheney and Rumsfeld. I mean, Cheney and Rumsfeld are, you know, both old right-wing wasps. Neither of them, I guess Rumsfeld started out kind of as a moderate, but was always a Republican. And same for Dick Cheney. The neocons are their own weird little sect of ex-leftists. And they're essentially, you know, a couple of generations of them and a few different sort of origin points. But basically, they are the intellectual progeny of Kristol and Podhoretz and of Leon Trotsky, really, before them. So essentially what it means, they're ex-Trotskyites who became Reaganites and, you know, over the generations. But you had, you know, really at the founding of the National Review, all the old right wingers were old and dead. The whole thing, you know, post-World War II, not much of the old right survived the war. And the few who did were essentially done by the mid-50s or so. So when William F. Buckley came and founded the National Review to be the headquarters of the right and to conflate the right with conservatism, which was not always the same thing, he hired a bunch of ex-communists. You know, Sidney Hook and James Burnham and Whitaker Chambers and all of these guys were all ex-Reds. And they came in to be really the founders and the dominant force in the conservative movement. One thing is, they were Americans, not Russians. And two, they were Trotskyites. So they hated Stalin. And then that was convenient that they could side with America in the Cold War and be, you know, well-kept intellectuals siding with the U.S. in the war and siding with their home country in the war, even though they had been hardcore leftists before. And then you had Leo Strauss was also another ex-communist who then went ex-Trotskyite who went to teach at the University of Chicago and was the professor. He and his buddy Wolfstetter, who I believe was also an ex-Trot. And they, the two of them, were then, not that they were exactly the same, but they were both ex-Trotskyites. And then they became the professors who taught, you know, a whole new generation of neocons like Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle and I think Elliot Abrams. I'd have to go back and check, but there, you know, there's this whole group that worked for Leo, or, you know, studied under Leo Strauss at the University of Chicago. And then they went to go work for Scoop Jackson, the senator from Boeing, as they called him, the senator from Washington State in the early 70s. And so then during this time period, you had the 67 war and the Vietnam War, where the left became the new left, hippies, anti-war people. And they sided with the Palestinians and they sided with the Vietnamese, or at least, you know, against the American war in Vietnam. And they sided with civil rights for blacks. And this was something that really bothered the neocons. And you can read it. I mean, it's hilarious and ridiculous and comical to read My Negro Problem and Ours by Norman Podhoretz. And, you know, this is the guy from Commentary Magazine and the father of John Podhoretz. And essentially what he's saying is, to roughly paraphrase it, blacks aren't oppressed. Blacks keep beating me up, you know, it's basically the deal, right? Like he's this nerdy Jewish kid from New York City where he was the one being oppressed when he was growing up. And it was poor black kids who were the ones oppressing him. And so then he takes this whole lens and he puts it on Israel-Palestine. And he says Israel is a nice little Jewish boy just trying to get home from school and do his homework. And the Palestinians are the black kids beating him up and won't let him go home or whatever. You know, so this is his whole kind of frame of reference. Thaddeus Russell seems to think like this is really like the core of neoconservatism is nerdy little Jewish kids who are afraid of big, mean black kids in the big city. You know, it was, you know, quite a big part of it. And they really rebelled against the civil rights movement and all that and against, you know, liberal and leftist Jewish alliance with blacks on civil rights, you know, that helped really push them to the right.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to that really, really quickly. Yeah. I feel like a lot of these neocons, a lot of whom are Jewish, and there's also that Irish and Italian Catholic element, which depresses me because right? I'm Italian Catholic. But, you know, a lot of these Jewish neocons, they even don't think that, you know, the Jewish community, they don't think the Jewish community is hawkish enough. I mean, you have these figures like Michael Ledeen, and what I really wanted to get at here was, you know, you mentioned William Norman Grigg, and I actually like a lot of Grigg's writings, even though I'm more to the left-wing end of the spectrum, but what's really interesting is I don't think we need, like, a New World Order conspiracy. I don't think we need all this Alex Jones stuff. We know the names. We know it's Richard Perle. Yeah. It's people like Michael Lind.
Well, and by the way, thank you for saying that because, you know, William Norman Grigg quit being a New World Order conspiracy kook right at the turn of the century, right really around the same time that I did. That really there's a lot more going on here than just the CIA rules everything. And there's a lot more going on here than some plot to build a world government that really is not what's going on. Now, if they really meant that, they'd have brought Russia into NATO. And they didn't, did they? No. So there's something else. And I think, you know, especially by the time they're marching into Iraq, Will Grigg was no longer a New World Order kook. Like I was saying at that point, just kind of the frame of understanding that endless war weakens America was really the benefit that they brought from the old conspiracy theory to this new correct one, which was Bin Laden understands this too, essentially.
So then we get involved in the forever war. Who are the beneficiaries of this other than Bin Laden? Obviously, I'm sort of referring to who did the neocons sort of bring into their alliance? Who were the sort of players behind it? I think it was like Kutz on one end and then the weapons contractors on the other.
Yeah, and all the big foundations. So And to get back to our story, there's one more major faction of neocons is the Shockmanites, a guy named Max Shockman, who is another former Trotskyite who had founded the Social Democrats USA. So then the National Review, the Straussians, the Shockmanites, all these guys, we're talking about less than 100 guys, essentially, here. And you're right, they're not all Jewish. There are, you know, at least a handful of Catholics like Jean Kirkpatrick and William Bennett. And I'm sorry, I forget off the top of my head. Certainly Zalmay Khalilzad, who studied under Strauss, is not Jewish. He's a Muslim from Afghanistan. So it is a very Zionist movement, but not explicitly a Jewish one. And again, it's a very small number of people. You know, Jim Loeb, who himself is Jewish, wrote this great piece. Well, he's the number one world, the world's greatest expert on the neocons, I think, living today. And he wrote a piece called All in the Neocon Family about, you know, the Kagans and Victoria Nuland and all this stuff, and how essentially all these people can all meet together for Thanksgiving. They're all essentially, you know, related to Gertrude Himmelfarb and Midge Dechter by at least marriage, you know, and they're, it's a very small, tight-knit group of guys. And then so when Reagan came into power, a bunch of them went and joined the Reagan administration, especially in the Defense Department. And then at this point, too, they took over all of the foundations. You know, the right-wing foundations, the Olin and Bradley and Scaife foundations were the biggest ones, but then also Heritage and AEI. So, and then in the 1990s, as you said, now it wasn't Cheney. Cheney was the Secretary of Defense, but it was the neocons that were called the crazies, meant to be kept in the basement, and especially that meant away from Middle East policy. They can kill Salvadorans down there, but keep them away from the Middle East. They got way too bad of a conflict of interest there. Then in the 1990s, they coalesced around Bill Kristol's efforts, and Rupert Murdoch gave them a bunch of money to found the Weekly Standard, and then they went on to create the Project for a New American Century. And you know, Kristol and Kagan famously wrote Toward a Neo-Reaganite Foreign Policy for Foreign Affairs magazine in 1996. Oh, I should have mentioned, in the Bush senior years, after Iraq War I, it was Khalilzad and Libby and Wolfowitz working for Cheney, who wrote the Defense Planning Guidance, which was the blueprint for American global domination after the fall of the Soviet Union and in the aftermath of Iraq War I. And it was the neocons who were, you know, were the brain children behind that. Oh, I also skipped it. In the 1970s, they ran the Team B review, where they, you know, built up the Soviet Union to be way more powerful than it was. And they pushed those lies all the way through the 1980s. And that's why Robert Gates, when he was the head of the CIA, famously missed the fall of the Soviet Union. It's because they were right in the middle of this massive PR campaign to try to pretend that it was 10 feet tall and ready to take over the whole world. And that's GDP was twice what it really was. And all of this stuff, too. Yeah, exactly. Listen, the more we can't hear their super secret silent submarines, the more of them there are out there. You know, just total nonsense, you know, Iraqi WMD type circular arguments and garbage. And then so in the 1990s, then they created the Project for a New American Century and pushed through the Iraq Liberation Act. And it was the neoconservatives led by Richard Perle and David Wormser. I think Wormser really did the writing. But Perle and Wormser were the ones who pushed this clean break policy for Israel, for Benjamin Netanyahu. And see, that's the joke, too, is Netanyahu, when they originally wrote the clean break, it was when he was prime minister the first time in 1996. By the time of the war, Netanyahu was gone and Ariel Sharon was the prime minister. Now, they were both Likud, but they were pretty much two separate factions of Likud. And it wasn't Sharon that really wanted Saddam Hussein. It was Netanyahu who and his faction who were more intent on American regime change in Iraq. But it was Netanyahu who was closer to the neoconservatives, not Sharon. Sharon was hell-bent on going after Iran and wanted Bush to go to Iran first. And then you'll remember pressured Bush out loud, you know, not even secretly, but publicly pressured Bush that you have to go to Iran next. But anyway, to make it very brief, and you can read it all up in A Clean Break, A New Strategy for Securing the Realm and Coping with Crumbling States is the companion piece. And there's even a book called Tyranny's Ally, which is America's Failure to Remove Saddam Hussein by David Wormser, with a foreword by Richard Perle. And the strategy goes like this. If we overthrow Saddam Hussein, then Jordan will be the dominant force in Iraq. And the Iraqi Shiites, the supermajority, don't worry. They love bending over and doing whatever they're told. And what we'll do is we'll have our new Jordanian influence in Iraq. We'll order the Iraqi Shiite clergy in Najaf to order Hezbollah in southern Lebanon to stop being friends with Iran and to start being friends with Israel instead. And Jordan and Turkey will have total dominance over Iraq, and Syria will be totally screwed and, you know, in an island by itself, separated from Iran and separated from everybody. Now, this is total garbage, completely inane and stupid. And you read David Wormser's reasoning, it's not reasoning at all. The guy's like, he might as well be a college freshman giving it a try, but he doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. He thinks that the Hashemite kingdom in Jordan will rule over the Iraqi Shiites and they'll do what they're told. He says, well, the Iraqi Shiites, they'll obey anyone who claims to be the descendant of Muhammad. But that's not true. And the Hashemites are Sunnis, and they don't have anything to do with Muhammad's son-in-law, who was the founder. You know, I forget all their names. Imam Ali, I think, is the – I need to go back and reread this stuff. But anyway, the point being, the Shiites do revere certain family lines of Muhammad. But that doesn't mean they revere the Hashemites. They don't at all. And even where they revere a certain family line, that doesn't mean that it gives them total authority, you know, any more than the Pope gets to tell every Catholic what to do all day, every day or whatever. It's not that kind of authority anyway, you know, like the Pope rules all Catholic states from the Vatican or something. That's not so. So they just had a total misunderstanding, and it was fed to them by, guess what, an Iranian-backed Iraqi exile named Ahmed Chalabi, whose job it was to feed these idiots whatever they needed to hear in order to get them to get the Americans to overthrow Saddam Hussein for him.
I was just going to add to that. I feel like we have to promote at this point. If people haven't read it, read Trita Parsi's Treacherous Alliance, which deals with a lot of this.
It's such – and look, this is all in enough already too, as long as we're bookshopping today. And listen, so there's a great piece you find at Salon.com. It's called How Chalabi Conned the Neocons by John Desart. And I mean, what can you say, man? It's all in there. They quote Douglas Feist's law partner, Mark Zell, saying, man, Chalabi, he really screwed us. He promised us all this stuff. He promised us he's going to build oil and a water pipeline to Haifa. And the new Iraq was going to be best friends with Israel and do whatever we said. And boy, he used to have one group of friends, and now he has an entirely different group of friends. That dirty SOB, you see him, you tell him, I said, screw you, and rah, rah, rah. And then he has another quote. And this is a quote of a guy quoting a guy. It's not me talking. I'm just telling you what John Desart quotes a guy is telling him. One of Chalabi's friends in Jordan. Says, I said to Ahmed Chalabi, I don't know, man. I can't really trust you palling around with the people that you're palling around with there in Washington, D.C. What's happened to you? But then Chalabi told me, this is, again, not me talking, but this is John Desart quoting a guy, quoting himself, talking to Chalabi. And then Chalabi told me, don't worry, I just got to get these Jews to believe whatever I want them to believe long enough to get the war started. And then we can do whatever we want. And so then that was it. They were suckers. Ahmed Chalabi played them. And then he was the same guy whose group came up with all the lies about the weapons of mass destruction. And once the war began and the weapons were nowhere to be found, he told the Daily Telegraph, we're heroes in error. Who cares if we didn't find the weapons? At least we got the war started. And that's all we needed.
And look at what it has all wrought. I mean, even beyond Iraq and Afghanistan, I mean, look at Libya. I mean, for listeners, you know, we don't have to like Gaddafi, but what did killing Gaddafi do? It just created more of this. It's unleashed more terrorism.
Yeah, well, it was never about terrorism. In fact, Wormser says, I'm pretty sure in Tyranny's Ally, he goes, or it might be in Coping with Crumbling States, actually. He goes, look, man, you know, some critics say that the overriding problem in the Middle East right now is Islamist terrorism, and that, you know, getting rid of Saddam could make that worse. And then he says, yeah, but the Baathists are just so bad, that we couldn't possibly settle for them instead of terrorists. We're just going to have to pursue this regime change, and then we'll worry about that terrorism problem later. And the anti-terrorism alliance will have to rely on better men than the Baathists. In other words, I made up my mind, and you bring up this really great objection to my stupid conclusion, and I'm just sticking with it anyway. Right? You're telling me Bin Laden's a problem, and that maybe Saddam with the clean-shaven chin and the French beret might be a good way to keep Bin Laden down and out in Mesopotamia. Well, screw you, because I already decided I want him gone. And so now he like rationalizes it away. You know, anti-terrorism will require better partners than the Baathists. But why? I mean, Saddam Hussein is an atheist. What better partner could you have for killing Bin Ladenites than him? The guy in the French beret who's terrified of these jihadists, you know, whose secret police are probably good for one thing only, keeping Bin Ladenites down. And then that's the guy you're going to frame. And then what do? Al-Qaeda hits us and they go, now's our chance to go after Saddam. You know, so like, in other words, David Wormser could be that dumb of an idiot in 96. But then Khobar Towers blows up, and then the embassies, and then the coal, and then 9/11. And he still won't change his mind. He still says, oh, yeah, no, but still, Baathism is way worse. To who? Only if you put Israel first. And if you, you know, Philip Zelikow, who had been Condoleezza Rice's right-hand man and was the principal author of the 9/11 Commission report and all that, he was very frank about this. He said, Israel is the unsaid reason for Iraq War II. The reason we're doing this is because Saddam Hussein pays the families of Hamas suicide bombers. And in fact, he paid the family of any Palestinian who was killed fighting in fighting with the Israelis. So that meant a little old lady's house got demolished with her inside it, or a suicide bomber. Their family would all get a check from Hussein. So that was, in a way, you know, subsidizing and paying for suicide bombers. And the neocons, as Philip Zelikow said, this wasn't a very good sales pitch to the American people, that never mind our towers coming down, Saddam subsidizes Hamas doing kind of one-off attacks in pizza parlors in Tel Aviv when Americans don't know where Tel Aviv is, right? But that was one of the main reasons that they wanted to do this, something that wasn't even an existential threat to Israel, much less to the United States.
I just wanted to add to that. Zelikow's not even the only one. I mean, I in the book, if I'm recalling correctly enough already, I think you even talk about Colin Powell having issues with the neocons when it came to Israel.
That's right. Yeah, he called Feith's Office of Special Plans in the Pentagon Feith's Gestapo office, and told Bob Woodward that Dick Cheney and the neoconservatives had created a separate government inside the government for the purpose of pushing us into that war. Thomas L. Friedman, who's, you know, renowned for some reason as America's greatest public intellectual there at the New York Times, he gave an interview to Haaretz that I quote at length, where he says, it's them paraphrasing him, but extremely closely is the way the quote comes. It's kind of odd the way it's phrased, but essentially he says, there are 25 men within 5 miles of where we're sitting right now. He maybe even says within 1 mile of where we're sitting right now. And if it wasn't for those 25 men, the war would not have happened. And he's referring explicitly to these neoconservatives. He's not talking about Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld. He's talking about Wolfowitz and Pearl and Douglas Feith and William Kristol and Robert Kagan and Charles Krauthammer and this very small group of tightly organized neocons at their think tanks, at AEI, PNAC, WinEP, JINSA, and, you know, the Weekly Standard and the National Review. Don't forget Jonah Goldberg and his friends at the National Review, Michael Ledeen, and all of those kooks. And how, you know, that's all it took. That's all it took, man, was less than 100 men, some of them in the government, some of them in the media and the think tanks. And it was enough to, you know, stampede a country into a big fake war. By the way, Richard Pearl is the same one who refused to accept Saddam Hussein's essentially unconditional surrender twice before the war. And it was reported separately, two different opportunities by two different intermediaries. Why in the world they went to Richard Pearl is beyond me. They They should have tried to reach one of Colin Powell's men or something instead of going to Netanyahu's guy. But anyway, you know, there's one by Risen and one by Seymour Hersh. And the one by Risen, Saddam says, listen, if this is about oil, you can have mineral rights. I'm willing to let Exxon pump every drop I got. What do I care about that? You can have it. If this is about Israel, I'll switch sides and abandon Hamas. Screw them. And I'll support Israel in their side of the negotiations. I don't care about that. If this is about weapons of mass destruction, you can send the FBI and the army around to look wherever they want. We don't have anything. I swear to God, you guys know that. And if this is about, which, by the way, so Saddam Hussein doesn't even know why he's being invaded, by the way, right? So he's like going down the list too. If this is about elections, I'll hold elections under international supervision. Just don't attack. Pearl told the emissary to tell Saddam and his men, we'll see him in Baghdad. Now, is it unconditional surrender not good enough to stave off a war?
Real quick, too, and I just want to make this note so people don't misinterpret us. When we talk about the neocons and we do separate them from the Cheneys and the Rumsfelds, I don't think at the same time that we're letting the Cheney and the Rumsfelds and the Bushes off the hook either.
No, well, look, I mean, they're the principals on the committee. Paul Wolfowitz, you know, was the undersecretary of defense. Feith is the deputy secretary of defense for policy. Bush is the president. Cheney is the vice president. Rumsfeld's the secretary of defense. No one doubts that. But the thing of it is this, man. You know, Bush has this motive. I want to go to Iraq. It's going to prove I'm tougher than my dad. I'm going to go all the way to Baghdad. I'm tougher and smarter than him. I'm going to get reelected. Rove wants him to get reelected. That's his job. Cheney had helped run Halliburton into the ground and owed them a bunch of money for all the horrible decisions he'd made as CEO. Rumsfeld wanted to beat the army over the head with transformation of the military to focus more on special operations and air power. Right. So they all had their motives. But then they all turned to Wolfowitz. And Wolfowitz says, listen, me and my egghead friends have gamed this all out, and it's going to work. It's going to be great. My friend Ahmed Chalabi says, once we overthrow Saddam, our guys are going to have total dominance over the situation. They're going to make Hezbollah be friends with Israel and whatever, pipeline to Haifa. Everything's going to be wonderful. So, you know, without that, it would have been much more difficult. You know, if they just had to ask Colin Powell and the experts at the State Department, they'd get a hell of a lot different answer about how easy and wonderful this is going to be. You know, so that played a major role. And then also, they were the ones who manufactured all the bullshit. They were the ones who came up with just the endless pile of lies about Saddam's ties to Al-Qaeda and production of weapons of mass destruction, and funneled all that through their so-called stovepipe into the intelligence stream and into the media to get us into that war. So in other words, there were a lot of, I mean, it was a very top-down effort. It was not like the Republicans of America all were determined to do this. It was Bush and his government and the neocons who were determined to do it. But without the neocons, it could have never happened. They were the key to it all.
I just wanted to add to that. I mean, I think you can even point towards very specific players. I mean, Ledeen was involved with the Niger forgeries, so I mean,
possibly.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure about that. You know, at this late date, exactly what his role was in there. I mean, what he was trying to do, he was trying to frame Iraq and Iran for working together on a nuclear program, which was completely ridiculous, and that never did happen. But that's what they were trying to do with those Rome meetings there. But look, I mean, there's just no question that they were the ones who organized for the Iraqi exiles to tell all the lies. They were the ones who funneled all that stuff into the media and straight up the stovepipe to Bush's intelligence briefings and so forth. So, you know, they were the ones who built the consensus. And this was, you know, someone asked me the other day about, oh, I did Robbie Martin and Abby Martin's show.
Right on.
And they were asking me about Fahrenheit 9/11 by Michael Moore. And in there, he doesn't mention the neoconservatives or Israel one time ever at all. And I think the answer someone was asking me on Twitter why this was. And I think the answer was because he never heard of them. He had no idea being kind of a typical progressive and just looking at the world through his biases, he saw Houston. He saw Exxon. He saw James Baker III and said this is a war for oil, when that wasn't what it was about. It just wasn't. And you know, at that time, though, there were very few people who really knew what a neocon was or even had heard that term. And there was for quite a long time. I really think this is true. I mean, I don't know how you could prove it going back. I guess look at LexisNexis and whatever. But during the dawn of the Iraq War, Justin Raimondo was basically the only person carrying the entire weight of trying to explain to the population of this country who's a neocon, what's a neocon, and what makes them different from James Baker III. And so many people just didn't understand. They just had no idea of the reference. And really, all the stories, or the vast majority of the stories about the neocons at the Pentagon and the Office of Special Plans and the way that they lied us into war, those all broke in the summer of 2003 when it was too late.
Karen Kwiatkowski.
Seymour Hersh. I'm sorry?
I said Karen Kwiatkowski.
Yeah, so Karen's articles, you know, based on her first started coming out earlier during the run-up to the war, but they were just in Knight Ridder newspapers. It wasn't enough to really take off. The first big pieces that really broke through the consciousness, I guess, about that was Seymour Hersh in The New Yorker when he wrote Selective Intelligence. And the next one was called The Stovepipe. And those two, you know, then after that, there was, you know, and maybe even before that, there was stuff by Jason Leopold, by Jim Loeb, of course, by Raimondo. But I'm trying to think who all had written about the Office of Special Plans so early on. Anyway, I have them all in the index of the new book. I have links or, you know, not links, but titles and authors of all the best articles from that era on who the neocons were and how they lied us into war. Oh, you know what I forgot to include there? There was an ongoing series at Salon.com by Sidney Blumenthal, Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton's guy, Max Blumenthal's father. But he was a guy who was so plugged in that he knew the difference between Jim Baker and Richard Pearl. He wasn't making that confusion whatsoever. This, to him, as he covered it, this is a major faction fight. It'd be like assuming all football players are on the same team because they're all on the National Football League together. Zoom in a little tighter, and you got major rivalries going on within this organization. You know what I mean? And so that was something that Sidney Blumenthal did a really good job of writing about at Salon.com. In fact, that'd be worth going back to reread some of that stuff where he talks about, you know, the bad blood, especially between these guys as they're taking power from each other, you know?
So before we close out, I just had two more things I wanted to cover briefly, if we could. The first is, you know, I know you're on the libertarian end of things, and a lot of people, antiwar.com, are even on the sort of paleoconservative side of things. And one thing I think I notice about the right and conservatism, at least in the mainstream, is there's still these sort of Robert Spencer type figures, you know, Jihad Watch. And I think a lot of conservatives have been taken in with this idea that, oh, Islam is out to get us. You know, they hate our freedoms, or Islam is just an inherently violent religion, when really, you know, even bin Laden, even Wahhabists and Salafists, the Wahhabists and Salafists that are supportive of terrorism, even that's a small number within those right. ranks. Could you talk a little bit about what people don't understand about Islam?
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, that was always just a bunch of public relations garbage. Yes, of course, it's true. Bin Laden and his guys were Islamists, and they want an Islamic form of government, and so they're the forefront of this insurgency against the U.S. But that doesn't mean that they hate us because we're not Islamists. They hate us, the U.S. empire, for standing in the way of them achieving their goals over there, which, again, they only had 400 guys. They never could have achieved any of their goals anyway, even without us in the way. But that was the way that they looked at it. And so, you know, the same reason as, you know, we hate them for what they did to us. We don't hate them because we're predominantly a white Christian nation, and then therefore we're hell-bent on killing Muslims and taking their stuff away. That's not what it was. They knocked our towers down. Remember? Or how could you forget about that? So it's the same thing. It just never was about that. It's a giant red herring. And look, it's mostly pushed by a bunch of Zionists because Israel's enemies predominantly are Muslim. They don't want you to think about Palestinian Christians at all. But they want to conflate the Israeli position with the American position and their enemies with our enemies and say, you know, who's evil? Them. They're all just a bunch of Eastern orcs and they must be crushed by the forces of light and this kind of thing. When it's just a bunch of crap, right? It's just a bunch of public relations spin. It never really was true. And then look at this. Isn't it funny how during Donald Trump's government, he came in talking about, oh, Hillary Clinton won't say radical Islam and all of that crap, like really kind of baiting, you know, on that kind of far right, as you say, Robert Spencer, the anti-Muslim guy and all those guys. But then once he got in there, he kind of dropped that. Right. And the liberals were all obsessed with this Russiagate total hoax for 3 years. And, you know, the Republicans are demonizing China while the Democrats are demonizing Russia. And then guess what? Everybody just forgot about, oh, Sharia law is taking over America if we don't stop them. Whatever happened to that? I thought that was an emergency. Now, all of a sudden, it's not a thing at all. Why? Because it was never an emergency. It was just a PR stunt to make it seem like, well, geez, why would they be passing resolutions to protect us from Sharia law if it wasn't a threat? But that's exactly why. To make you think that. That's all.
And I mean, all we really need to do, to be honest, is I think if you read Bin Laden, if you read the literature of these radical elements, they'll tell you why they hate us. It's not they hate our freedoms or, you know, the U.S. isn't religious in the way that we want them to be. It's get your military bases out of our countries. It's blowback.
In fact, you know, so my last article I mentioned earlier was Peter Bergen is wrong about mistaken about Bin Laden's strategy. It's at antiwar.com/Scott. Just go there, antiwar.com/Scott. Right there at the top is the YouTube of the Peter Bergen, Peter Arnett interview with Bin Laden from 96. And the whole thing is about supporting Israel and bases in Saudi. Nobody says a word about hating freedom because they hadn't come up with that line of BS until 2001. It was George W. Bush that made up that crap, or his speechwriters that made up that crap in 2001. Before that, it was absolutely clear. Nobody doubted for a minute. What was the motive behind the attack? It was just as plain as day. It was just as they said. And here's like, you know, John Miller going, yes, they hate us for supporting Israel and our bases in Saudi Arabia. Back to you, Jimmy. Right? Like, you can't get more explicit than this. There is no other explanation except the explanation that we were given by the guy who did the thing that he did. So what is there to even argue about? There's nothing to even argue about. And you know what? If you got a second to indulge me here. I didn't mention this when I was on with Dave, but I thought of this and I remember listening to this back in 2002 on Chaos Radio. Someone was playing this on Chaos Radio and it's David Cross, the comedian David Cross on September 11th. And it's a minute.
Seriously, if the terrorists hated freedom, then the Netherlands would be fucking dust, you know? As would Denmark and Sweden and Switzerland and New Zealand and Canada and every other country that's truly freer than we are. But it's true. And I don't think Osama bin Laden sent those planes in to attack us because he hated our freedom. I think he did it because of our support for Israel and our ties with the Saudi family and all our military bases in Saudi Arabia. You know why I think that? Because that's what he fucking said. Are we a nation of six-year-olds? Answer, yes. God damn it. Why did the bad man put the plane in the building? Because he hated freedom.
All right, anyway, so I'm pretty sure that that's from 02, that that's even before Iraq War II, you know. And it was funny because he and Dave Smith got into a fight about free speech at some thing. And he was saying, you know, people saying the wrong bad thing should be banned from the internet and not allowed to say it and all that. And then I told Dave later about this. It was too bad Dave didn't know about this to bring this up to him. But like, man, boy, in 2002, the government would have banned you from saying that. So maybe we'll just let, you know, the chips fall where they may and let free speech stand. Because here's one where David Cross, look, when David Cross said that, it was a big deal, dude. When I heard that on the radio, it was like, whoa, man, somebody finally had the courage to say it, because no one would say it. No one would say it. Same with Doug Stanhope, had one that came out in 2002 where he's saying true stuff about, you know, freedom. And it was like, oh, my God. It's like, seriously, it's like catching a breath after almost drowning. You know what I mean? It mattered that these guys were being that honest in a time of such universal, you know, pressure and self-censorship from those kinds of messages, you know?
I wanted to add one last thing to that, and then we'll wrap up. I like how he mentioned the sort of Saudi element to all of this, because, you know, it took us how many years to get those 28 pages from the Senate Select Committee investigation into intelligence activities around 9/11? You know, and I know Literissa, your wife and a great journalist herself, has covered that. You know, for years we weren't allowed to talk about that. The families weren't allowed to get justice. They're still trying to get justice in the families lawsuit against Saudi Arabia. And, you know, no one talks about free speech when it comes to that.
Yeah. Well, you know, they just announced today that Biden is going to have the Justice Department review and release a few more documents. And that's because the pressure of the families. And boy, I bet they wish, too, that they had thought of this earlier. But they said to Biden, don't come to any of the 20th anniversary remembrance ceremonies unless you see fit to declassify these documents, or you're not welcome. Now, man, they should have pulled that on W. Bush or even Obama back then, you know, but to pull. Oh, what a great man. They should have come up with that a long time ago. And think about, you know, how powerful that is symbolically. You're telling the president of the United States you can't come to a September 11th ceremony. That's right. I said I want the documents about the Saudi money. Give them here. Right. That's how you do it. You know, in other words, go for the jugular, man. Ruthlessness and nothing else, nothing short of that is going to get it done. You know, you want to be absolutely shamed as the president who can't go to a 9/11 remembrance ceremony? Are you going to do what the hell we say? You know, got to hand it to him.
So wrapping up here, I guess the last thing I wanted to ask you, just in closing, you know, I'm from the left. You're on the more libertarian end of things. You know, there's other people that are on the more conservative end. But I think a lot of us can coalesce around opposing the empire and opposing the wars. For the people that don't seem to understand why we need this type of coalition that we're seeing from places like the Quincy Institute and anti-war, you know, what would you tell people? Like, for instance, you know, my mom, she's kind of normie and moderate in her politics. What would you say to people that don't yet get the point after 20 years of this crap? What would you say to them for the people who don't get what these wars have wrought?
Well, look, you know, America's warfare state is the worst thing about our country, and it's essentially the worst thing in the world. I mean, what can you say? They killed 1 million people over, you know, an attack by a tiny little group of bandits, right? Look, when Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, they didn't have to hijack our airliners to crash them into the Arizona, right? They had fighter jets. They had an empire. Bin Laden didn't have an empire. Bin Laden didn't control a single district, not a single county in no man's land in the Nangarhar province. If your mama knows where that is, it's in no man's land on the far side of exile from anywhere. And just because their attack on September 11th seemed equivalent to Pearl Harbor doesn't mean that their power ever was or ever could have been in 1 million years. It just ain't so. And so what happened? Bush exploited that violence, pretended that there was a Japanese-sized Islamo-fascist caliphate empire out there that had to be fought. And then what did he do? Him and Obama, they went and overthrew a bunch of secular dictators, went and killed 1 million people who didn't do it, had nothing to do with it. And then what have they done to our country in the meantime? They blew $10 trillion. They completely distorted and ruined the economy by causing the crash of 08 with their artificially low interest rates to make the wars seem free before that. They shredded the Bill of Rights into tatters with not just the Patriot Act, but all of the different legislation, Freedom Acts and the rise of the Department of Homeland Security, the unleashing of the FBI, CIA, and NSA electronic spying against the American people, the rise of the militarization of the police that makes Bill Clinton look like a Quaker or something, the way that they have turned over all this military equipment to the police across the country through the military 1033 programs and all this. You have these MRAP mine-resistant vehicles that weren't even invented until a couple of years into the Iraq War to protect against landmines, and now given to every deputy sheriff's department driving around in these behemoths to intimidate the people. And, you know, remember after Ferguson, they kill Mike Brown in the street, the protesters come out, and that night, it was like they called out the 3rd Infantry Division to face down, you know, unarmed poor black protesters. And, you know, I know there's been a lot of Antifa violence and riots and crazy things since then. But think about, well, and even then, those same militarized cops, they won't do a thing when there's looting and rioting going on. But they'll unleash full military force against peaceful protesters marching in the daytime in the middle of the street. And they'll crack their skulls right open. And then just all the partisan division that really began with the lies over the Iraq War. Half the people thought that Saddam did 9/11 and that the other half of the country were such treacherous, traitorous, sissy, liberal, anti-American, horrible people that they didn't even want to defend America against a country that had attacked us. Then the other half of the country thought, no, you stupid goddamn idiots, it wasn't Saddam. You're just dumb and believe lies. And so there was a lot of hate there. And then 1 year later debuted, oh, by the way, yeah, we torture people. And of course we do. And all good, right-thinking American patriots support torture, too. Otherwise, I got to go to jail. And so then what happened? The right half of America signed up for that and decided, yeah, that's right. We're torturers. That's what makes us the red, white, and blue. We torture people to death. And then, again, the left half of America, you know, and the right half of America divided that much further from each other over that. And that's before Barack Obama ever got elected. That's before birtherism. That's before, you know, the rise of the New York Times jihad over race to distract us all from the Occupy movement and all of that kind of thing. And that's what got it all, you know, kicked off.
That being said, I think opposition to imperial hubris and empire can now become a sort of a unifying thing for all of us.
That's
across
right.
The political spectrum.
Totally, I agree.
Listen, if you're, and I'm just saying this for my listeners' sake, if you're a progressive and you want things like Medicare for all, you know, you can't do that if you're having all these wars, if all your tax dollars are going to that. If you're a libertarian, you really don't want your tax dollars going to the wars anyways. It's like, no, that's my
right.
money. And then if you're a conservative, you know, if you're a conservative and you don't believe in restraint, I don't consider you a conservative. So all of these things should really be unifying us right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially on financial matters. And look, this is the kind of thing that right wingers don't like to pay attention to, but it's the kind of thing that honest ones called out from the very beginning. What comes with wars? With long deployments comes broken marriages, cheating wives and illegitimate children, and drunken revenge killings in the middle of the night, and God knows what kind of disruptions to the lives of the people in the military. It ruins their lives to have to go fight this stuff. Not all of them, but many of them. And it's you know, it's that Rage Against the Machine song, rally around the family with a pocket full of shells. Well, which is it, right? You care about peace and justice and liberty and the rule of law? Or militarism, because you have to choose. You can't have it both ways.
So, Scott, I know I kept you about 10 minutes over. I feel bad about that. I could talk to you forever, but how can
my
listeners keep up with your work?
All right. Well, I am the director of the Libertarian Institute. That's libertarianinstitute.org. I'm the editorial director of antiwar.com at antiwar.com. I am the host of Anti-War Radio on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. on Sunday mornings, even though I live in Austin. I'm on the radio in L.A. And I've got I do the Scott Horton Show. I've got 5,580 or 90-something interviews for you at scotthorton.org and at youtube.com/ScottHortonShow. And I wrote Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terrorism. And I also published The Great Ron Paul, which is the transcripts of 30-something interviews I've done with Dr. Paul over the years, and plus a speech I gave about how much I love the guy. And I think that's it. Follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show.
Thank you again, Scott Horton, for coming on Parallax Views.
Absolutely. Happy to do it anytime.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. Hope you enjoyed my conversation with Scott Horton. That particular conversation was a long time coming. I actually have another interview with Scott from a few months ago that there were a lot of technical issues with, but I may actually be able to work releasing that one. We'll see. I really, really, really am glad Scott was able to come back for a re-record. And like I said, it was a long time coming. So I hope you enjoyed that conversation. Please be sure to check out Scott's work at scotthorton.org. As always, if you support the work I do, please, please, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There's $1, $5, $10, and $15 tiers. Any amount will help, and I could really use it. It's crunch time for me as we approach the end of the year, and I'm currently taking care of another family member. I've mentioned this on previous shows. I don't like putting too much attention on it because I feel like, you know, I don't want to come off as a beggar, but if you appreciate the work I'm doing, this is my main source of income, is the Patreon page. So I do this full time. It is for you, the listener, and I really need your support to keep this show going. And I could really use that support because, to be honest, I'm not in New York, so that actually can make things a little bit more difficult. If you're not in New York or, say, LA, which are huge media centers, you know, getting the visibility you need to get a lot of contributions isn't always easy. You know, I ain't Chapo Trap House here. And I'm not dissing Chapo when I say that. I hope no one takes it that way. It has nothing to do with dissing Chapo, but I'm not in the sort of New York scene, and I'm not connected to the New York media space directly. So, you know, that affects things. Same, you know, even the LA scene, the media scene, it can be much easier when you're in one of those cities to really break through with media work. And that's just sort of how it is. So I really need your help as a listener to keep this show going. It's very important that I get contributions for the show so I can, you know, make a living off this and do it full time. I mean, you know, this is my full-time gig. So if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that in mind, let's get to the producers' credit shoutouts for the $10 and $15 tiers. Producers' credit shoutouts to Mark, Arlen, Spartacus, Gunner, Ed, Gratz, James, Jamie, Mickey, Brian, The Warnerd, Emilia, Chase, Orc, Black Tuna, Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Martin, Brian S., and Jeffrey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on every edition of Parallax Views, then consider supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. There's been some problems in the past with, you know, for some reason, I didn't get notifications for two people that were at the $10 or $15 tiers from Patreon. So if that happens, just shoot me an email or shoot me a message on Patreon. I will, you know, profusely apologize to you for, you know, if I miss you in the producer's credit, and I will immediately put you on the list I have out when I'm reading the producer's credit shoutouts. So I'm pretty sure I have everyone that is currently on the $10 and $15 tiers on the producer's credit shoutout list. So if I missed anyone, please contact me because you're paying good money to get the shoutout. Anyways, patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com parallaxviews if you want to support me. As I said, any amount helps. $1, $5, $10, and $15 tiers. Patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.